This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Rabbi Brent.
Shalom, Joan. Lovely to be back here with you today.
Well, Rabbi Brent, you have lately been to Israel. When did you go? Why did you go? What were you doing there?
I had made these plans to be in Israel, wanting very much to go and participate in a particular program, a 3-week seminar study for rabbis in Jerusalem at a place called the Hartman Institute, Merkaz Hartman.
Now, what is the Hartman Institute?
It is an organization that was founded by the late David Hartman, a rabbi and philosopher and student of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who parted with his teacher, decided to make Aliyah. After some time in Israel and reflecting a good deal on the situation there, saw a real need, not only in Israel, but also around the world, to have a reset and to think about ourselves. And so he created this institute where he brought together some leading scholars from throughout the Jewish world, academics and rabbis and statesmen and policy wonks and all kinds.
Wow, that sounds like a think tank supreme.
That's what he called it. He called it the think tank. And the whole intention of the think tank was to discover, in his words, and find, nurture the next Rambam. Of course, Rambam being Rabbi Moses ben Maimon, Maimonides, the greatest Jewish mind of all time from the 13th century, Sfard, of Spanish Jewry, who, of course, moved during his life, living most of his life in Fostat, in Egypt.
So to find another Maimonides.
Yes, it's a pretty audacious goal there. Maimonides is uniquely a product that comes from the golden age of Spanish Jewry. And I've heard Danielle, who's David Hartman's son that currently runs the Institute, say that if it were not for Maimonides, he wouldn't be a Jew today. You think about statements of statements. So who was Maimonides and what did he do? And I know we talked about him during a couple sessions a few weeks ago, but just to share.
Reactivate.
Yeah. Maimonides is a rationalist to the core. And in a time where science and philosophy and all manner of knowledge and understanding of the world that previously hadn't been, had been explored, but not really in a concerted, organized effort that ended up ultimately giving birth to the modern world. And I think Maimonides was really the first modern, if anyone. He deliberately started speaking and talking about seeing the Tanakh, the Bible, as containing many, many allegories. And that when Moses is said to go up to Mount Sinai, he's doing Aliyah la Har Sinai, he's actually doing Aliyah beruchani. He's doing a spiritual Aliyah where his mind, his thinking, his understanding is elevated to a level that he encounters God as something more like the first cause that Aristotle knew than as the God that is pictorially and anthropomorphically described in the Bible. God for him as described in the Bible was just the Bible speaking in human language, because that's what our minds were capable of that time. And actually, the kernel of wisdom within Judaism was much, much deeper and more profound. And Maimonides still speaks today to many, many modern Jews around the world.
There are circles who still...
Well, and this is the center of it. Merkaz Hartman could also probably be called Merkaz Rambam.
So what was he looking to discover amongst the think tank, or the same qualities that Maimonides had?
I think that the challenges faced by Judaism as recognized from within Judaism are profound. That today we still, with every other major religion around the world, by the way, too, are struggling to make sense of and find a way to exist within the modern world. And all of the challenges that confront us, such as living as part of national states, being integrated with co-religionists who aren't members of our own faith. I probably didn't say that clearly, but being integrated with Christians and Muslims and atheists and Buddhists and Confucians and, you know, all the people that we encounter on a daily basis here, Jews of past centuries would have never experienced this. The fact that our knowledge has increased so that we can look through a microscope and see DNA and read within it the building blocks for what characterizes every single species on this planet. How do we intellectually understand all these things, along with the fact that our world, despite this progress, is still a place that's filled with deep, deep conflicts and hatreds and genocides, unfortunately, have not left our present. And all these challenges are things that, for us to remain committed to our faith, we need a lens through which to understand them. And I think that the Hartman Institute, along with others throughout the world, aspire for Judaism to provide that lens.
And how did they go about it? Where did you fit in?
This is an institution that has a 30-year plus history, and for me, this was my first encounter with them, learning in their campus, learning from their faculty.
So they're well known.
With 150 other rabbis from around the diaspora and from within Israel, a few. And pluralistic. It was rabbis that were very traditional to rabbis who were very liberal and modern and humanistic, even.
All men or women, too?
Absolutely women. Absolutely women. There are many women rabbis around the world. We've had them on occasion in New Zealand and definitely visiting more frequently in New Zealand, but we don't have any currently. They do exist, and our listeners should know that some of the best scholars out there are women.
So is at the Institute, women are together there
with
the men.
Many of the best scholars out there are women. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So that even the Orthodox accept the...
Yes. There is a spirit of collegiality that's part of the culture at Hartman, which means that I can sit down at a table and engage in study with a woman who is the immediate past president of the largest denomination in the United States. And I did meet this woman, and I did talk with her, and I didn't even know who she was until the last day. I had not a clue, and it was just like we were friends, and we were in the room together, and there's countless other people that were there. People like Sarah Hurwitz, who is the first woman Orthodox female rabbi. Putting all those words together sounds really strange to some listeners, I'm sure. But yes, there's one out there, Sarah Hurwitz.
I didn't know there was one. I didn't know they accepted it yet.
Thank you, Rabbi Avi Weiss.
And so you had to apply to go.
Mm-hmm. I had to apply to go. And this is a curriculum called the Rabbinic Torah Seminar, RTS. That had approximately 120 rabbis who participated in it. And there's a deeper program, which is a three-year commitment with weekly meetings and I think two trips a year to Israel, that is called the fellowship program, the Rabbinic Leadership Fellowship. I was part of the entry group and really discovered at Hartman something that animated me, something that was a common mind rabbinically in a set of colleagues who I felt at home with, and I felt engaged with, and I felt like we could discuss in our environment all manner of issues and disagree, by the way, as we rabbis and certainly being Jews do. And
do you live in, you know... Or do you go every day?
I was at a hotel, and I walked every day about 10 minutes to get there in Jerusalem and in the hot desert summer, which was a nice change from wet and rainy New Zealand.
So you meet during the day and have discussions and so on, but does it go on into the night as well?
It is. From 8:30 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. every single day for weeks. And the structure that they follow is what your yeshiva bochers will know, or it's a Beit Midrash, a study hall structure. You go in, there's an introduction given by whoever the presenter is for the first block, and then you have texts, and it's text-based learning, so depending on how many texts the speaker's chosen from, all sorts of sources from Bible, poetry, rabbinic literature, politics, you know, UN documents. And we study them all like they're scripture and then come back together. And there's a lecture given by the presenter who tries to weave all the texts that have been pulled out together.
And so do you report back to the presenter who then incorporates it, or...
You can ask questions and you can participate in that way, but typically the Hartman within their center have a particular way based on the Brisker School, which is where Soloveitchik comes from, of looking at texts. And what they're looking at is not necessarily what are the legal decisions here. I mean, they don't really care so much what the halakha is, what the Jewish ritual law, you know, is it kosher, is it not kosher? Yes, we need to know that. Yes, we need to be able to have a coherent system for kashrut. But the way that Briskers look at the text is to say, this person that's speaking to this person, what is this person really trying to say? What's their modus operandi? And what's this person who's responding interested in? And you look at it in such a way so that you see a dialogue and a presentation of ideas and a striving to figure out, you know, what is the good way.
The right way.
The right way, the good way, sure. Our theme for the summer was also extremely relevant for the time I was there. I arrived on the 26th of June, when three boys had been kidnapped outside of Hebron, and their fate was not yet known. Of course, we know now that they were murdered by presumably some Arab Palestinians who lived in the area. And then the situation in the Middle East that's still ongoing right now started to unfold. So our topic during these 3 weeks I was there was war and peace. Interesting time for an interesting subject.
And so you looked at the scriptures to see all the wars we've been in and what happened, or...
Yes, but not how? only the scriptures as well. I looked at a lot of documents. You know, the Jewish world is
awash with documents.
but you know, documents that come from within and documents from without, and you know, poetry and prose and all manner of things. There were sessions that approached war and peace from all different angles. What is the way that war and peace is understood in the classical text was first. What is the situation in Israel, and in what is the way that Israeli culture has channeled the themes of war and peace through its poetry, its art, its music, its culture? Every culture does this in different ways. I mean, we have it here with Anzac Day, for example. What is the mystical understanding behind war and peace?
So you go to Kabbalah as well?
We had a session on Kabbalah and the inner struggle of war and peace. Absolutely.
So it must have been absolutely fascinating.
It was astonishing. It was incredible.
Was it mind blowing?
Look, I feel like I've drunk the Kool-Aid coming back.
And this went on for how long?
I was there for 3 weeks total. The seminars dates for the program I was in was 2 weeks running from Sunday to Thursday. And Shabbat was on your own. And those students that were part of the fellowship program stayed on. And I actually did, because I was in Israel a little bit longer, get to participate in some of the things that they did as well.
Why is it called fellowship? What does it entail?
Well, this is their three-year program. So what I did, it's a one-and-done summer. You go, you study for the summer for 2 weeks, and then you're back in your prospective community, and conceivably you still have a relationship.
Oh, so you don't stay there for 3 years.
Well, they don't stay for 3 years.
These are
working, busy rabbis who are all either serving congregations or some of them other institutions, but predominantly congregations. And they participate in a three-year program where their requirements include being in Israel twice a year and having weekly conversations. And
are these monitored at all, or is it just left all, to the students?
I think that within their group they do record them on the internet, but I don't know how much is available publicly. at the end of the program, there's a graduation, though, and you become an alumni of the fellow program, and they're now in the fifth iteration of this program. I don't know what the absolute numbers are, but I imagine probably it's somewhere around 120 to 150 rabbis have been trained in this way,
it's like a post
accreditation for rabbis.
Right. So do they keep in touch, on the internet or?
They do, absolutely, and I keep in touch with many of the people who I've just recently met them there, and we already feel like lifelong friends.
So the conversations continue.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So it's like the old commentaries, isn't it? Only it takes place here and now.
Yeah. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I like that. We're creating our new commentaries. Yes. And what you just said, Joan, has a lot of truth. Because for me as a Jew, as a rabbi, what we understand Torah, our most sacred central text, to actually mean is not only the five first books of the Bible that are in the Torah scroll, but also that Torah literally means instruction, and that whenever any two Jews gather anywhere in the world or more, and they have conversations, they talk about these things, that this is also Torah. Torah continues to unfold.
So it's what they call it, a work in progress.
Yeah. All of life is an eternal work in progress until the Messiah comes. Yes.
So it's, I always thought of the Torah as, this was the Torah and this is it. I never thought of it as a living document that can change. Mm.
It's not so much that it changes. So we have this idea that within Torah we have majority and minority opinions, which is actually similar to what legally is understood in court systems today, and done in court systems today. Court systems are in a large way based on Talmudic argumentation, especially when you look at the British Common Court. These conversations are said not to change what is done, because the minority opinions or previously held to opinions are always preserved, but rather they allow for Torah to continue to unfold so that you can see on the new spread that comes out from Torah, new ways that revelation is interpreted to modern situations. I mean, I don't think the Jews walking around the desert had cell phones and knew all the particular questions that would come up around cell phone usage. So we have to have a way to respond to that, right? That's part of what we talk about with being in the modern world.
So you have to, it's like the ethics committees that, look at medicine and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I never thought of them looking at cell phones and mm-hmm. recorders and mm-hmm. and so on. So where does the fire goy come in?
Where does the what come in?
The Shabbos goy.
The Shabbos goy is in there.
So for 3 weeks, you went every day, had conversations which were put on to you, so to speak. And what was the outcome? What was the outcome you expected within the 3 weeks?
Well, the outcome personally for me was that I felt nourished, both intellectually and spiritually. And I think the outcome intellectually was that I expanded my understanding of the topic War and Peace within Judaism mm-hmm. deeply, and of many other topics that came up on the periphery of that major topic. And I think that when you learn anything, you also learn with it and appreciate with it that there's more to learn, and so that thirst is still there.
So if it was for rabbis, it means that the rabbis have to pass it on because they don't keep it only. I mean, that's why they're rabbis. They have to teach.
Right.
So the lessons you've learned, you then have to pass on. How do you intend to do that?
Well, I think that for me, my approach to understanding what you just said is that this is part of my education as a rabbi, and everything that I've learned is helping me in some way to be a better rabbi. That is not the direct intention when I'm in these classes, though. For me, it's Torah lishma. It's l'shem shemaim. It's Torah that is for the sake of heaven, and just learning and soaking it all up. It's something that we each to honor God, to honor God's creation, to bring beauty to that creation. We recite in Peah, in one of the sections of the Mishnah, a major work of the second century. Elu divarim she'en lahem shior. The Talmud Torah kenegid kulam. There are things without measure, but the study of Torah is equal to them all.
Well, you read about people spending their whole life in studying the Torah. And in olden days, I think mm-hmm. the men who, and it was men then, who studied Torah night and day were sort of respected, and other people had to maintain them because they were... and they had the leisure to actually study all the time.
Yeah, I have some issues with this idea. And it's not only olden days. I mean, these are things that are issues presently for the state mm-hmm. of Israel, and that the last major election that happened in Israel was not about any international issue or the Arab question, for example, but it was rather a question of what does Israel do with the fact that we have large numbers of young people who are going off to yeshivot, to schools, to study Jewish sacred texts, and that they're getting exemptions from the army, and that they're being given a dole by the government to do this. And when that happens, it's a drain on the society, and you can't perpetuate a society that way. You know, the rabbis that are spoken of in the Talmud, they all had professions. They were carpenters, or
doctors.
They were doctors, or bricklayers, or money changers, or whatever it was. They all had their professions, and there was an understanding that ironically, considering what I do, no one is supposed to make a living out of their Torah, out of teaching Torah. The teaching Torah needs to be for a higher purpose, and money doesn't honor it in that way. So for me, which I think is the correct understanding within Judaism, We're not learning merely to learn. We have to learn also to do. And that's part of the Hartman Institute's mission, is that by bringing all of these scholars and all of these rabbis and all of these thinkers together and having them discuss some very difficult issues, that when that happens, you find within it a understanding of how we should be conducting ourselves in this world, and that if we don't change our behavior, then what we've learned is also not of value. You need both.
So words are not enough. We need deeds as well. And is that
that's the one.
That's the message. Because I was just thinking here, you say people, thinkers and philosophers and doers all get together to look what's the best way.
Yeah.
And in the ancient days, they had no way of actually getting together, but they still managed to have disciples come from all over the place. How did they communicate?
Well, we're very blessed to live in the modern world, aren't we, where we can hop on a jet plane and make it across the world to sit face-to-face with a colleague. And at the same time, there's other tools that we still know how to use today. They wrote letters, and there were letter carriers. Believe it or not, there was a postal service even in biblical times. And people could send messages back and forth to each other. And this was largely how communication occurred. But you know, you're also talking about a group of people that were never squeamish about hopping on a ship and traveling or loading up a donkey cart and setting out on the road. The road, of course, in those times, had its
perils.
You don't stop living just because you're being threatened.
But, you know, you had great, like the Gaon of Vilna, he had disciples who followed him. How did they know about him? You know, how did they spread the word? There must have been peddlers or somebody that, like traveling people.
I think that you only have to look at how quickly news travels within communities today to think that they were no different than us. We're all human. And we all face similar challenges throughout all times. I mean, this is part of the message of Judaism, that we're part of an eternal struggle, an eternal people, to complete God's creation. And communities talk, people talk, and when there's someone you hear about that's a great light to the world, like the Gaon of Vilna, it's going to make it out there not only to the Ashkenazi world, but you know, you better believe that Jews who were in the Sephardic world and also at that time in places like Sfat were well aware too.
Well, thank you, Rabbi. I'm pleased that you felt nourished and reinvigorated, and I'm sure that it will have an effect on the whole community. So thank you for coming, and I look forward to our next
thank
session.
Thank you. I should hope so. That's what I'm here for.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10 past 10 to Radio Shalom. And if you've missed this program, you can go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom.